We made our way through much of chapter 18, actually, on Sunday. We went up to verse 27, I believe, up through the rooster crowing. And now we're going to work our way through the rest of chapter 18 and into chapter 19. We'll see how far we get there. As we move our way through, I know that there are some areas where I really believe the Lord wants us to look closely or a little more closely at some things that are rooted in the Old Testament and are good for us as Bible students, no matter how long you've been in the Word, are good for us to see some of these things. And so depending upon how much time we have, we'll see what we can do there. I know we went long last week, and we don't want to do that again. Some of you don't care, but it is important. We're trying to keep this as close to an hour as I can. Okay. I probably won't move too much between the Gospels, although at times I'll make a comment like, you know, John doesn't tell us too much here, but Matthew says this or Luke says that. But just so that we can kind of keep it flowing as we work our way through. As I mentioned, we left this on Sunday morning at verse 27. We looked at the arrest of Jesus, his time with the guys as they walked into Gethsemane, the Garden of Gethsemane, the place of the olive press, Jesus sweating great drops of blood, three times petitioning his Father, "Father, if there's any other way," he said, "let this cup pass from me, yet not my will but yours be done." Great pressure, a pressure beyond anything that you and I can comprehend. When the contingent comes to arrest Jesus, we see Peter pulls out his sword. He clips the ear off of Malchus. But, you know, we can almost have a little fun with that. But at the same time, it's important that we keep focused on just how serious this was and just how, I'm trying to avoid a word, but just how difficult this was, obviously, for Jesus. But for his guys. They loved him. They're trying to process what's going on. They don't understand it fully. All of them, all of the 11, desert him. Peter follows John up into the high priest's residence, in the courtyard, I should say. John goes into the residence. Peter stays in the courtyard. We read how he denies three times that he knows the Lord, and the rooster crows. So Jesus has been arrested sometime late the night of Passover. We call it Passover Eve, but Passover had actually begun at that evening. And now it's the middle of the night, and he's moved from Annas' house to a number of the others to Caiaphas' courtyard. Caiaphas was high priest. These men are corrupt. They've run through what I call a kangaroo court. They've determined that they've convicted Jesus of high treason by proclaiming himself to be God, blasphemy, as they see it. And they're going to crucify him. It's important that we understand, and I think some of you know this, but the Romans had taken the power of capital punishment away from Israel. Pompey conquered the area in 63 BC. And from 63 BC until the early part of the turn of that century, Israel still had sovereignty. I mean, they were under the boot, but they still had some sovereignty, and witnessed by the fact they had the right of capital punishment, which was stoning. After, and scholars debate this, so we'll call it nominally sometime between 7 AD and 13 or 14 AD. It doesn't matter to either one of us right now. Rome removed the right of capital punishment from Israel. Now, in doing that, you have to understand, you go back into Genesis chapter 49, verse 10, that the scepter, it says, Jacob had prophesied that the scepter would not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. And in saying that, it was understood that until Messiah himself comes, Israel would continue to have the right to rule. So at that point then, nominally, we'll just call it 10 AD, when the right of capital punishment is taken away. There were the high priest at that time, and I forget his name, doesn't matter to you, I guess, but tore his robes, saying that the Torah had been broken because the scepter, the right to rule, the scepter had been removed from Judah, yet Messiah had not come. And yet, in a carpenter shop up in the Galilee, in Nazareth, there was a young boy, the Messiah. So God always keeps his word. It's just not obvious to us at the time, perhaps. So I say that because now the Jews know they want to kill Jesus, but they can't just do it any way they want to. They have to deliver him over to the Romans. They want to see the Romans take care of this. So they do that, and they determine then that they're going to go to Pilate's residence. So we pick up there, verse 28 of chapter 18. They led Jesus from Caiaphas's house to the praetorium, and it was early morning. Now, it was early morning, and as you try to work through everything, Jesus is going to be on the cross by 9 a.m. At 12 p.m., the sun will go dark. It's not an eclipse. There are some people. In fact, I think it was Josephus who had said there was an eclipse, but there was no eclipse. It couldn't have been an eclipse. It was a full moon because it's Passover. There could not have been a solar eclipse at that time. And so it went dark. And there are many reports around the world of it having gone dark. But in any event, Jesus is on the cross by 9 a.m. At 12 p.m., it goes dark until 3 p.m. when Jesus cries out his last. It's early morning then, and as you try to work through it, it's probably sometime between 4:30 and 6 a.m. that they make their way to the praetorium. And as they come over, you need to understand, don't expect that Pilate is awake at 4:30. Now, he's going to be awakened, presumably, and some of this I'm just adding, but I'm just trying to put this in so you get a sense of what's going on. Pilate had a great hatred for Caiaphas. There was great antipathy between these men, and yet Caiaphas is the one who's steering the ship from Pilate's standpoint. And so Pilate's in a jam because he's not in the greatest favor with Rome because he's allowed some riots to take place in Jerusalem and Rome. If you've heard of the Roman peace, it was all about keeping the peace. Now, Rome kept the peace their own way, I always say. It was the iron peace, the Pax Romana, you know, the Roman peace. I always say, you know, that's a, you keep it a peace and we break it, you face, okay? And that's basically the attitude that they had. And so here's this Roman prefect who didn't keep the peace a couple times. So he's not in the greatest standing with Rome at this point. And the Jews know this, so they're going to try and twist him as well as they can. Just a footnote for those of you who are interested in these things, you know, I'm sure you know that there are always those critics who will say that the Bible is not true, or they'll say that certain things that are said in the Bible, you can't prove that historically. And one of those was whether Pilate even existed. Now, you and I believe, I'm assuming, that Pilate is a real man, and he was. But it wasn't until, I believe it was the very early 60s, that it was proven that Pilate existed. Now, it was always believed by Bible scholars that he existed, but higher criticism and some of those powers in Christian scholarship, we'll say, had said, you know, there's no evidence of this. I believe it was... It could have been as late as 67, but somewhere in the early to mid-60s, in a flyover of the Mediterranean coast of Israel. It's important, you know, when you go to Israel a couple times, actually on tour, we've seen lots of sand in the air, because sand sometimes, it just blows up from Egypt. And you think over thousands of years, all the sand that blew up over so many of the Roman ruins and other ruins along the Mediterranean coast. And someone saw a horseshoe-shaped feature in the sand And as they began, as the archaeologists began to dig, they found what we call Caesarea. Caesarea, not Philippi up in the mountains, but Caesarea Maritimus on the coast, where Paul was imprisoned, etc. And so, and Pilate would have had a residence there. But there in Caesarea was found a marble plaque that says in Latin, Pontius Pilate, the Roman prefect. Now, the original of that is in the Jerusalem or the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, but you can see a replica of that at Caesarea. Anyhow, so Pilate, of course, real man, he's the Roman prefect, and they're going to try to get what they can out of Pilate. They want him to kill Jesus. They want Jesus dead, but they want Rome to do it. They want to take it out of their hands so they don't have a riot on their own hands. That's really their motivation, I would say. Here they are knocking at the door, and whatever time you think it is, it's 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning. This is the middle of April, 32 AD. Pilate is probably being awakened, and they're at the Praetorium, and this is a palace. This is a beautiful marble palace in the middle of Jerusalem, right next to the Temple Mount. And so he would be awakened, told that, you know, there's a contingent of Jewish leaders here. They have a man who they have under arrest, and they want you to bring judgment against them. And Pilate's attitude is, tell them to go away. Just tell them to go away. Take care of it themselves. And, of course, he'd be told, look, they're not going away. They really want you to handle this. So begrudgingly, I'm assuming he's saying to somebody, okay, make me a cup of coffee. And he's getting robe on, someone probably shaving him. I say that because you wouldn't expect that he would have shaved himself. And getting himself ready, and he would have probably entered into his what you call the greeting room, where his throne room was, and then told by an aide, no, sir, they don't want to see you in here. I mean, it says they came into the Praetorium early in the morning, whatever time that was, but they themselves did not go into the Praetorium. Who? Caiaphas and the other, the priests and the other leaders. They didn't go into the Praetorium lest they should be defiled so that they might eat the Passover. In other words, they knew that if they set foot into a Gentile house, they would defile themselves. Then they wouldn't be able to eat the Passover. So now, you need to process this. Pilate's not a Jew. He's sick and tired of some of these guys, particularly Caiaphas. So now he's told, no, sir, they don't want to see you in here because they'd be defiled coming into your residence. How do you think that went over? Come on, seriously, how do you think that went over? So then Pilate would have gone outside. So when you read this, I mean, I'm going to put some inflection, and maybe I'm going to be wrong in some cases, but I think you need to, I'm not dramatizing it just for the sake of drama, but I'm trying to put some of this emphasis on here so you get a sense of the antipathy between Pilate and Caiaphas and these guys. So Pilate went out to them, verse 29, he said, what accusation do you bring against this man? And they answered, they said to him, if he wasn't an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you. So Pilate said to them, well then, take him and judge him according to your law. And therefore the Jews said to him, well, it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death. You took it away from us. We can't put him to death. It's not lawful for us to put anyone to death, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled in which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. Jesus had already said that he would be crucified. So this is keeping true then. These are people who don't want to keep Jesus' words, but they're just doing it, whether they don't know it, but they're actually keeping his word for him. That the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled by which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die. Then Pilate entered the praetorium, and he called Jesus, and he said to him, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered him. And what was this like? You need to really think now of Jesus' attitude. Don't think of an argument. Think of the compassion that Jesus has for Pilate. And Jesus answered him, he said, Are you speaking for yourself about this? Or did others tell you this concerning me?" Pilate answered him, "Am I a Jew?" I mean, look, he's torqued. You got to understand, he's torqued. And Jew is kind of like, it's shooting out of his mouth. "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, think about this one. "My kingdom is not of this world." How does Pilate take this? "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." How's Pilate taking that? I wonder, how do you take that? One of the things I've noticed, I have to tell you this. I noticed this over the last 14 months as, you know, as church leaders, we've dealt with this whole matter of, okay, we shut down the church back at the middle of March because we knew that it sounded right based upon the little bit of information we all had. It sounded like, well, there's a dangerous virus going around and we need to be good citizens and be careful here. And most of the church leaders I know did that. There were some who didn't, but most of us did. And since then, as we process through, well, how long are we going to stay shut down? 2 weeks is one thing. 6 weeks, 10 weeks, that's another. We need to reopen. We need to reopen because we don't answer to Harrisburg. We answer to Jesus Christ. He defines who the church is. He's the one who tells us when we should be open and when we should not be open. We don't get our marching orders from Harrisburg or from Washington, D.C., for that matter. I have to tell you, some of us just returned from the East Coast Pastors Conference, and this was a topic that came up so often in many of the teachings that we heard, particularly from people like Mike McClure out in San Jose, with everything that he's been through in this last year, standing up to the county government and saying, no, we have to be open. Jesus calls us to be open. At this point, he has in excess of $2 million of fines against him personally for having done that. But did it because he answers to Jesus Christ. We have to ask ourselves, this is an important question that each of us have to answer. Who do we answer to? Do I answer to God or do I answer to man? And this is not the time to go into a huge piece about that, or we wouldn't stay in John 18 any longer. But I say that because the question is, who's the king? Who really is the king? And in this case, since my citizenship as a Christian, and yours if you're a Christian, our citizenship is in heaven. Oh, we have a dual citizenship of one sort, you know, I live in Bucks County and all that. And I have voting rights here, but my real and lasting citizenship is in heaven. And I eagerly await my Savior from there, the Lord Jesus Christ, who with one shout is going to transform this lowly body into one unto like his glorious body and yours as well. And we need to keep this in focus. So when Jesus says now to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom really was of this world, then my servants would fight so that I wouldn't have even been delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom isn't from here." So Pilate then said to him, verse 37, "So you are a king then." I mean, you got to have some compassion for Pilate. He doesn't know what's going on. He's just working his way through his first cup of coffee here. "So you are a king then." And Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I'm a king, and for this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into this world, that I should bear witness of the truth, to the truth. And everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Now Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" You know, Pilate's the product of his culture. So Pilate is the product of Greek philosophy. Pilate's the product of Roman cynical philosophy as the rulers of the world, as they saw themselves, seeing so many religions of the empires that they've conquered. there's the question, what is truth? You and I have an understanding of truth that's quite different than the rest of the world today, and for that matter, of anybody who's lived throughout all human history. But make it very clear for yourself that Pilate, yeah, he's struck by this question of truth, but also, what does Jesus say? For this cause I was born, speaking of being a man, but look what else he says. And for this cause I've come into this world. Oh, he was sent into the world. There's a purpose. He's beginning to speak, and he'll say more of this. He's beginning to speak of his own deity. So this is going to get Pilate trembling. And again, as I said earlier, there are things that John does not record from us. But as this mourning begins to go on between 6 or so in the morning until Jesus is finally nailed to the cross at 9, his wife will come to him and say, "Have nothing to do with this just man, for I have been greatly troubled in a dream today by what I've heard of this man." And dreams meant a lot to Romans in those days. And so Pilate's going to take that seriously. He's troubled. He has this sense, and we all get it. He had the sense that I need to be very careful what I'm doing with this man. He doesn't trust the Jewish leadership. He realizes that it's because of envy that they've turned Jesus over to him. So Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he said this, he went out again to the Jews, and he said to them, "I find no fault in him at all." I mentioned a couple weeks ago, it was 4 days earlier that Jesus had made the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. That triumphal entry, the day he made that entry, on the donkey, coming down the Mount of Olives and on up into the court of the temple courts, really, into the city of Jerusalem. That was the day specified by Exodus 12. God told Moses in preparation for the Passover, 4 days before the Passover. So the Passover is on, the Jewish month of Nisan, on the 14th day. On the 10th day of Nisan, 4 days earlier, take a lamb without blemish and present it to the leadership and have it approved. This is a lamb that has to be without blemish that you're going to sacrifice 4 days from now. And so Jesus presents himself. Interesting. He presents himself in Jerusalem 4 days earlier. And here now is Pilate casting judgment. He's putting down his own judgment and saying, "I find no fault in this man." And he'll say it numerous times. I haven't counted them all up for you. That's your homework. But as you go through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you'll see multiple times he's fed up with the Jews. He doesn't see that Jesus is worthy of death. And he's just trying to get this problem away from him. So he says, "I find no fault in him at all." But he gets an idea. He says, "But you have a custom. You have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover." Passover is, this high holy day. And he says, "You have this custom that I should release someone to you at Pesach. So therefore, do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? I'll give you the king back." And they all cried again, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now, John tells us Barabbas was a robber. Now, he was more than that. He had actually led an insurrection. I think it's Matthew who tells us that. It could have been Luke. He actually led an insurrection, a real insurrection, not like the one everybody's been talking about from June 6th. That wasn't an insurrection. And by the way, Bar, I think most of us know enough of our New Testament to even be able to figure out what Barabbas' name means. Bar means son or son of. Abba, Av means father. Abba means really like daddy. It's a more intimate form of father. Jesus, when he prays in Gethsemane, "Abba, Father," he prays. "If it's possible, let this cup pass from me." So Barabbas' name, Bar Abba, son of the father. In fact, there are some sources that say his name was actually Joshua or Yeshua, Jesus, Bar Abba. So can just think of the linguistic confusion that's going on here. do you want me to release the king, to you the King of the Jews? In fact, if you're careful and you watch this, throughout, John gives it to us, but so do the other writers. Pilate is sticking it. In his own way, he's sticking it to Caiaphas and the other leaders. Do you want me to release your king to you, he'll say. So anyhow, he says, so therefore, do you want me to release to you the King of the Jews? They all cried again, not this man, not this Jesus, son of the Father, but Jesus, son of the Father, right? Barabbas. Now, Barabbas was a robber, an insurrectionist. That's why he was guilty of a capital crime and was going to be crucified. That's why someone would be crucified, guilty of a capital crime. So then Pilate took Jesus and he scourged him. In other words, Pilate has to get rid of the problem. He can see, I'm not getting rid of these people. I've got to do something. Don't give Pilate too much credit and see him as a highly compassionate man. He's not. He's just not. He was really a creep in a lot of ways. But you can see that he's caught in a situation that he'd rather not be in. He'd rather not be putting this man to death because he doesn't see anything wrong with him. So maybe he figures, okay, I'm not going to kill him, like crucify him, but I'll put him through the ringer. I'll almost kill him. So he had him scourged. Now, to be scourged, again, if you're not too familiar with this, a prisoner was taken, stripped down, tied over a beam, spread eagle, arms and legs, and you had two lictors, one on each side, with, we'll call it the cat of nine tails, but these with a stick, with these large leather straps with stone and metal and glass attached to them. The idea was that as the stone would hit the body, it would tenderize the body, so to speak, okay? It would soften the meat, if you would. And as those, just think about it, as the lashes would come down across the back, and the glass and the metal would grab a hold, and then they would pull and tear the flesh away from the back of that man. 40 lashes. Some say that the Romans did it only 39, and there's debate on that. But in any event, there's enough evidence that many died through this process. They never got to the cross. The whole idea of the scourging was to get the prisoner to confess, usually to confess, you know, who did he work with? Who are the other ones we need to arrest? Right? What does Isaiah tell us? He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, yet he opened not his mouth. Right? Jesus didn't think on you. Jesus didn't give way because he was innocent. He was not guilty of any crime. But he was going to the cross for me, for my crimes, my sins, and for yours. But he never said anything. So the idea is, if you confess, then they would lay the lash on lighter. They would show mercy, Roman mercy, to you. But if you didn't, they would lay it on harder and harder. So Jesus took it full strength. You need to understand that. And it was very typical for organs to be exposed. You may not like hearing these things, but you need to get this artwork that we have of Jesus with the, you know, that crown of thorns picture on his head with the little trickle of blood down his cheek. Forget that. He had nothing about him that you should desire him, Isaiah says. He no longer bore even the resemblance of a man. Having been beat up by the temple guards and now by the Roman guards and now scourged, he was a bloody, beaten piece of meat. His face was probably twice the size it would have been before from all the beatings. So they scourged him, and the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and they put it on his head. And they put on him a purple robe. And they said, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they struck him with their hands. Now look, I believe I said this at our communion before Resurrection Sunday, but when we go to Jerusalem, we always like to show this to people at a place called the Pavement, where the scourging would take place in the Antonia Fortress. The Antonia Fortress and the Praetorium were a part of the same complex. So the Praetorium was, you know, where where Pilate would have stayed when he was in the city, but the lower part of the Antonia Fortress is where they did the scourgings and the beatings. And they would bring someone who had committed a capital crime, they would bring him down there, and they had what we would call a game board carved into the pavement. You can see it there today. And they would roll dice. You know, these soldiers are there for 20, 25 years each. And many of them had a real hatred for the king. And they played a game called Kill the King. They weren't talking about the king of the Jews. They were talking about their own. They really had some problem with their own Caesar. And so they would put a scarlet robe on the prisoner. They would put a crown of the Jerusalem thorns on his head. They'd beat him. And they'd roll these dice, and it would make the man, you know, move a certain number of paces around. And then at the end, if he was going to the cross, if he had committed, like murder or something like that, they might just take a dagger and run him through, and he never even get to the cross. But because Jesus was a political prisoner, he was going to have to go to the cross. So they didn't kill him there, as they may have wanted to. But that's a game they're playing. That's why they put the robe on him. That's why they put the crown of thorns on him. That's why they're saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." They hate him. They hate him because he's Jewish. They hate him because they're just rough. They struck him with their hands. And then, verse 4, Pilate then went out again, and he said to the Jewish leadership, "Behold, I'm bringing him out to you so that you may know that I find no fault in him." And then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said to them, is it Ecce Homo? "Behold the man." And therefore, when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" And Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." See, over and over, he's saying this. And the Jews answered, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Ooh, therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid. And he went again into the praetorium, and he said to Jesus, and the emphasis is on you, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Now, Pilate's so fed up at this point. So Pilate, he's ticked. So Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me? Don't you know that I have the power to crucify you and the power to release you?" And Jesus answered, "You..." The emphasis now is on Pilate. Jesus said, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." From then on, Pilate sought to release him. Again, this is probably the point at which his wife is saying, "Have nothing to do with this just man." And it's possible, I don't know, this is a conjecture. It's possible from Pilate's standpoint, he's a combination of very superstitious, so he's not sure what to do with this man, especially based upon what his wife's telling him. And at the same time, some of the language that Jesus is using, this is not the kind of language that Pilate is used to hearing. So Pilate's probably thinking, he's a little nuts. I mean, seriously, I love my Savior. We try to see it through the ears or the eyes of Pilate. He's saying, "Don't you realize I have the power to crucify you or to release you?" Jesus says, "You'd have no power at all unless it had been given to you from above. It's the ones who turned you over to me have the greater sin." Who even talks like that? Who even talks like that after a scourging? So Pilate's seeking to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you let this man go, you are not a friend of Caesar, for whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." See, they've got themselves, they got it planned out. They know exactly what they want to say. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that's called the pavement. In Hebrew, it's called Gabbatha. Now it was preparation day of the Passover, and about 6 a.m. And he said to the Jews, look what he's saying, "Behold your king." He's trying to get rid of him. He's still trying to get rid of him. And they cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" And Pilate said, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priests answered, and let this sink in. The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Rest, silence. Let that sink in. There's an interesting passage. I've been referring a lot to Hosea lately. He says this, Hosea chapter 3 says this. Hosea is written, what, 6 centuries before Christ? 7? "For the children of Israel," this is Hosea 3 verses 4 and 5. This is prophecy now. "The children of Israel shall abide many days without king or priest." Oh, excuse me. Start over. "For the children of Israel shall abide many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or teraphim." What does that mean? There's going to be no temple. There's going to be no way of practicing this. Now, of course, that happens after Nebuchadnezzar destroys the temple, which is after Hosea writes this. But it's also going to happen in 70 AD. "Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king." How do you seek David their king? David died hundreds, for at least 4 centuries prior to that. They will seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter years or the latter days. And we're living in the latter days now, and we see how Israel is returning bit by bit, but they're returning to the Lord. So when they say, he says, "Shall I crucify your king?" We have no king but Caesar. Matthew tells us that they said, "Let his blood be upon us and upon our children." Chilling words, chilling words. We're told that Pilate called for a big bowl of water. He brought it out publicly. He washes his hands and he says, "I wash my hands of this whole situation." In other words, this is madness. Crucify him. If that's what you want, crucify him. And he can say that all he wants. And I think there's a tendency, and there's a part of me, I pity the man. Although I there's no reason, the more I've studied this over the years, the less reason I have to believe that Pilate ever repented of this and came to know Christ, but we'll see. They bring this curse down upon themselves. "Then he delivered him to be crucified. So they took Jesus and they led him away. And bearing his cross, Jesus went out to a place called the place of a skull, which is called in Hebrew, Golgotha." You've probably seen these pictures. I've shown some of this to you before. It is a skull. It was part of Mount Moriah. And Mount Moriah is not a mountain like we think of a mountain. Mount Moriah is a ridge system that starts in the south and continues to move up and up and up until it gets up to about 2,800 feet. But there's a place right up at the top, and this is no time to get into all the details of that now, but where Herod quarried the area in order to get the stone when he added on to the second temple. Remember, first temple was built by Solomon. It was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 586 BC. Rebuilt, we'll call it, nominally speaking, 400 BC by Ezra and Zerubbabel. And then it was very small. It was Herod the Great who added on. That's a crazy statement right there. He did a whole lot more than add on. He just built an enormous complex. No time to get into that tonight, but it's astounding what he did. But part of what he did is he quarried out the top part of that ridge system. So right at the very top, there's a cutaway. And actually, if you look at it, what he did is he cut it away so that he could take part of the mountain there, believe it or not, but watch my hands, so that he could, in effect, he didn't literally flip it, but he took stone from here and put it over here. So you have a slope coming up. He took stone from the top, put it over here to create a flat area. When you have free labor, slaves, and all the money in the world, you can do a lot of things. And that's what he did in order to create this enormous expanse so that he built the temple complex upon that. But at the very top, and you can still see it today, is the area of the quarry. And the edge of that quarry looks like a skull. Now, it's the Arab bus station down below it kind of takes, you know, it ruins the mood, you might say. But Golgotha, in Latin, it's the place of the skull. Golgotha means the skull, Golga. So in Latin, it's Calvaria, place of the skull. So when we say we're Calvary Chapel, you just tell your friends we're Skull Chapel. That's who we are. We remember the place where Jesus was crucified because this is central to us. And that's where they crucified him, with two others with him, one on either side, Jesus in the center. Well, there's a lot I'd like to get into, and I'm not going to be able to tonight. Perhaps we will at another time. I'd like to get into Genesis 22, but not tonight. You know, Luke tells us, here's the way it was set up. You had, when they crucified, when they would perform their crucifixions, the Romans always assigned four soldiers to each cross. So in this case, that means there would have been 12 soldiers up there, four for each man who's being crucified. And there was a centurion who had oversight responsibility for the entire operation. And we read about that centurion later on in this process. But I don't know what you have in mind as to what was going on at the time of a crucifixion. I think we all, as Christians, we probably have heard enough about crucifixions to understand the basics of what were going on. So they would take the criminals, they would lay them down. I say lay them down, it sounds so peaceful. They'd force them down. Who wants to be crucified? You'd be fighting with every muscle that you've got. You'd be doing everything you can. And they'd be taking these spikes, think of railroad spikes, and bam, with a sledgehammer, pounding them either through your wrist at the medial nerve, which create enormous pain when your arm is stretched out, the pain up into the chest area on either side. Sometimes they'd get it here. Sometimes they just put it in the hand. They would put one foot over the other like this. They put the feet down on the upright of the cross, and they drive a spike through there, through the metatarsals. I mean, if you've ever broken a metatarsal, you have a sense of the little bit of pain you have. Can you? It's hard to imagine. But, you know, these are the main nerve centers of the body. Romans had taken this crucifixion. They had designed a process of torture and execution that was designed to keep the prisoner alive as long as possible. The shortest crucifixion on record is 32 hours. The longest, I used to think it was 11 days. I just heard recently that it was 14. Either way, this is just staggering to me. And they put a little bit of a ledge, maybe about a 3-inch ledge, right near the prisoner's butt, because he would try to push up. The idea is you'd be slumping over, you're suffocating. And you'd think, well, just let yourself die. Your body will not allow itself to die. That's the whole point. You have the drive to survive. And so they did everything they could to stay alive. And they would put that little ledge there and a peg that was put in by the groin of the prisoner. And that actually helped to keep the person alive all that time. We often think, you know, on a hill far away, it's a great song. And it is a hill far away. It's the hill of Moriah, Mount Moriah. But where the prisoners were crucified were not up on a hill where no one could get to them. They were crucified right at the roadside so that as people walked past, that prisoner was not way up in front of you. The prisoner was basically on eye level with you. Rome wanted you to know, you don't mess with us, or this will happen to you. And they crucified him there with two others, Jesus in the center. You know, as you read through Luke especially, you got to imagine the screaming, the torment that's going on with these prisoners who are condemned, and now they're being nailed to these crosses. But Jesus is saying, and the idea is, if you read it through the Greek, over and over he's saying, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. I can't imagine being that calm. I just can't. I want to show you something very quickly. This is what we read here. And my apologies, I didn't have this to put into a PDF for you, so I can't give it to you online. Maybe someday I will, but you're going to have to trust me a little bit with this and read carefully. So we read here that Pilate wrote a title, verse 19, and he put it on the cross. So right above the head of the prisoner, they would put the charge against them, and Pilate put them there. It said, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. So I'm going to hold this up for you. It says, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Now we read that he wrote it in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. He wanted everybody to know. Now we read left to right. Hebrew reads, actually all Semitic languages. Languages to the east of Jerusalem read right to left. To the west of Jerusalem, they read left to right. That's curious, but you can figure that one out for yourself. In any event, it says, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Yeshua HaNosri Umelech HaYehudim. It's easy for you to say, John, I know. But it says, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, or Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. Okay? And of course, we know that the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, don't write King of the Jews, write that he claimed to be, or that he said, I'm the King of the Jews. Pilate answered, probably for a number of reasons, but most likely, number one, because he was fed up with all of them, what I have written, I have written. And the idea, the tense, the perfect tense of what he said in the Greek is, what I have written will always remain. I want to show you something. If you just carefully go with me for a moment, if you can see this, you and I don't read things the way Jewish people tend to read them, especially those who are very close to the language, especially those who are very are mystical in their approach to the language, because there's a lot of the kind of thing I'm about to show you is really, there's a lot of this in the Tanakh, in the Hebrew Bible. But what I want to show you is that if you take the first letter of each word, these are four words, Yeshua HaNosri Umelech HaYehudim. This is called a yod, like our Y. A he, like our H, okay? A vav, like our W. And another he, like an H. So, if you were to say Y-H-W-H, Y-H-W-H. But of course, you have to turn that around so it's right reading for us. We read left to right, and that would be what? Yod he vav he. YHWH, or Yahweh, Jehovah, the divine name, the ineffable name of God. Perhaps part of the reason they said, don't say that, is they understood what Pilate had written there, whether Pilate knew it or not, was that this man is deity, he's God himself. Then the soldiers, verse 23, when they had crucified Jesus, they took his garments, they made four parts, to each soldier apart, and also the tunic. And the tunic was without seam, woven from top in one piece. Therefore they said among themselves, let's not tear it, but cast lots for it, whose it shall be, that the scripture might be fulfilled. They divided my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots. You go back tonight, please, do this. It'll really benefit you, each one of us. Psalm 22. We're all familiar with Psalm 23, the shepherd's psalm. Psalm 22, written by David. Now, understand, written by David 1,000 years before Christ was crucified. First words of the psalm and the last words of the psalm are the first words and the last words of Christ on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me, David writes. In fact, if you read the end, you know, you remember what did Jesus say at the end? it is finished, right? Now we know it means tetelestai, paid in full, right? But it is finished. He says here in verse 31 of Psalm 22, he has done this. Basically, it's the first words and the last words. And no time to go into a long exposition of this, but I find it fascinating. This is written from the perspective, first-person perspective of a man being crucified. But understand that crucifixion, the Assyrians had something to do with some of this, but really crucifixion was made, what was invented by the Romans, at minimum 700 years before Christ. Excuse me, at minimum 300 years before Christ. Some would say much closer to the time of Christ. So here's David now writing this. This is written from the first-person perspective of a man being crucified. He says, verse 14, I'm poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. My strength has been dried up like a potsherd. My tongue clings to my jaws. You've brought me to the dust of death. Dogs have surrounded me. They've pierced my hands and my feet. Verse 16, I can count all my bones. They look at me and stare. They divide my garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots. We could go through a lot more. Let's come back to chapter 19. And therefore, the soldiers did these things. Verse 25, now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. Now remember, all the other guys have deserted him. And when Jesus therefore saw his mother, think of the compassion he has in the midst of this torment. And the disciple whom he loved, John, standing by, he said to his mother, woman, behold your son. And then he said to John, behold your mother. And from that hour, the disciple took her to his own home. There is the suggestion we pick up in 2 John that John is actually writing with reference to Mary. That's just a suggestion. Now, putting this in perspective, Jesus at this point now has been on the cross for 6 hours. He's gone through the first 3 hours of that torment, apparently not really saying anything. Now, as he gets into that second half of his time, after the sun is darkened, he cries out from the cross, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. And now, they had tried to give him some gall mixed with wine earlier on, but he refused to take it. In other words, it was there to dull the pain. He refused to take it. He took it full strength for you and for me. And then he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Think of the tremendous loss of fluid from the blood loss and all. His tongue is dried up. He can hardly speak. That's why, you know, they heard him and the leaders heard him. Hey, he's calling for Elijah. Eliyahu, Eliyahu. This is how you would say Elijah. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. That's really the idea. He's crying out. He's crying, my God, why have you forsaken me? So that you and I never would have to say that. Was it Calvin? I forget who said it. God forsaken of God at that moment. You go through Psalm 22 on your own and he describes the bulls of Bashan have encircled me. The whole idea of the fallen angels and the demons who are rejoicing while he's being destroyed from their perspective, destroyed on that cross. See, what's going on here is something far, far more destructive, more sinister, darker than you can imagine. And I believe with all my heart that you and I just don't get what the real battle is. As we go through our studies in Ephesians and in Daniel, and that'll start around the middle of June, I believe we're going to see over and over again that this is a great spiritual battle that we see us wrestling against flesh and blood. Even in our present day, we do it all the time. We point at politicians, we point at the media, we call them names, we think they're the enemy. When, yeah, I mean, think of, you know, Hitler, Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden, Adolf Eichmann. You can start to go down the list of all these wicked men who've ever lived, and they are wicked, and they were enemies, no doubt. But there's a force behind them that they've allowed to take control of their lives. But when Paul says to the Ephesians that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, we wrestle against principalities, against powers, against rulers of the dark world. You know, we don't see it that way, but we must learn to see it that way and stop categorizing people all the time. There's one category. We're all sinners in need of a Savior. That's our mission, is to bring the gospel of truth to each one. Knowing then that all things were now accomplished, he'd been there 6 hours, and that the scripture might be fulfilled, Jesus said, I thirst. You know, understand, this is a man's man who's crucified here. I know I've said this many, many times, but we have artwork that portrays Jesus, besides the fact that he looks like a European in so much of the artwork, because that's where the artists were from, but he's portrayed so often as a waif of a man. This is a carpenter. In those days, yes, carpenters worked with wood, and they didn't go to Lowe's or Home Depot to get their wood. True, they would bring down their own trees. They would rip that wood. They would fashion it into whether it was a window frame or a yoke or whatever it is they were making. He had muscles. He was a man's man. Don't ever miss out on that understanding. But also, there wasn't as much wood in Israel as you might imagine. So carpenters, they were builders, is the point. So they were also stonemasons. Jesus is a man's man. You know, he took the full strength of the scourging. You know, these guys are coming back. Often they would say, he's different. He's different. In fact, they're going to come later on to Pilate and say, he's already dead. Because crucifixion didn't kill him. He gave up his life. Now, knowing that all things were accomplished, Jesus said, I thirst. And a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled a sponge with sour wine, basically watered down wine. It was just some moisture. They put it to his mouth. And when he'd received that, in other words, now his tongue was no longer glued to his mouth. He said, it's finished. And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. It was finished. Paid in full is the idea. It was paid in full. You know, Paul says in Colossians chapter 2 that Jesus wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us. You know, when you were arrested convicted, that is how I should put it, when you were convicted of the crime, you had this idea that we have of a debt to society. You were going to be in a jail cell for the next 10 years, or, you know, you had to pay a fine or whatever it may be. And until you paid that fine, you were going to stay under the grip of the Roman government. But when you had finished paying your debt, they would put up a parchment on your cell saying, tetelestai, paid in full. He says in Colossians 2, verse 14, that Jesus wiped out the handwriting of the requirements that was against us, and he took it out of the way, nailed it to the cross. He disarmed principalities and powers. In other words, the devil knows he's got you. He knows he's got you if you don't know Jesus Christ. He disarmed the principalities and powers. He made a public spectacle of them, and he triumphed over them. In it. That's why he says, so don't let anybody judge you in all these religious things. These are just a shadow of what's to come, but the substance, that's important. The substance is Christ. So Jesus then cries out from the cross, tetelestai, it's finished. We're told, Matthew says, then Jesus said, Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. However that worked, it was unlocked. He was gone. His body remained there. Not a bone was broken. They came later on and they broke the legs, the femur, of the other criminals. So they couldn't stand up and get a breath anymore. But when they came to Jesus, he was already dead. And so we read that a soldier there thrust a sword or spear through his side and blood and water came out. We'll finish that next time when we come back to this. We're running late. Look, I really commend to you this idea of taking Psalm 22 and really working through it. And I think you'll find how amazing it is that God has already laid all this information out for us in the Old Testament leading up to this. When we come back next time, I want us to look at Psalm 22, but I also want us to look at Genesis 22, 23, and 24. And in a place that you would not expect, it's all written for us in one way there. You know, Paul tells us this. I'll end with this. 1 Corinthians 15. Brothers, I declare to you the gospel which I preached to you, which also you received and in which you stand, by which you're also saved. He says, look, for I delivered to you, first of all, that which I also received. In other words, which God himself taught Paul, which Jesus himself taught Paul, that Christ died for our sins. How? According to the scriptures. The scriptures tell us not just that he would die, but how he would die, the Old Testament. And that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day, according to the scriptures. He rose again the third day, according to the scriptures. Well, we can find enough hints in scripture that Jesus, that Messiah would die, and also the means by which he would die. But how many times or where do you find evidence that it would be on the third day? I'd like to come back and look at that sometime soon.